Hey, welcome to the Life 2.0 podcast. I'm John St. Augustine. Glad to have you joining me from anywhere and everywhere around the planet. Time to go up the down staircase in the outdoor, make sense out of the senseless, and if at all possible, find the obvious buried in the absurd. Let's get to it. Back at it again on the Life 2.0 podcast. I am delighted to have you connecting literally from around the planet. I've been doing this particular iteration of a podcast going on 4.5 years now, and I am always amazed at the responses and the emails and the comments and the questions and all kind of queries and other things that find their way to my inbox from places like New Zealand. I'm like, who? New Zealand? Who the hell's listening in New Zealand? But they are. And other parts around the planet. This technology is astounding to me. And I can't help but every time I open a show, whether it's this show or on Sundays, you'll hear me do the Tao of Music show in New York and Washington and also online. I can't help but think of how different technology is than when I started back in 1997. The first radio station I was at was little WDBC Radio. It was a CBS affiliate in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, the bustling metropolis of Escanaba, Michigan. And, you know, I've written about some of this in my first two books, Living an Uncommon Life and Every Moment Matters, about the journey on how I got into radio. And I have no background in it, no training, no journalism, didn't care about any of that stuff. But it was a very odd set of circumstances that put me in this direction. And a good friend, which we're going to talk about a little bit later in this show, helped push that upon me in many different ways. But when I first got into radio, that station, WDBC, had no talk show per se. And I knew, first of all, you know, at that time, music was just something I listened to on the radio. I wasn't going to be a disc jockey, which is a whole nother career path for people. And I have great admiration for that. But that's not what I wanted to do. I wanted to talk about things that I thought were important. At the time, I was really up against it on a lot of levels. And how I voted and where I went to school and, you know, all the things what sports team was my favorite. None of those things that are mostly talked about on radio were not going to help me get into the direction I want to go. So I wanted to talk about things that matter in life to a great degree. So they gave me 5 chances, 5 shows, 5 hours to get it right, whatever that might be. It was 1 hour a week for 5 weeks. And I was on after a guy named Al Holteen. And Al Holteen had been on the radio since Edison was born. You know what I'm saying? This guy was around for a long time. Literally, at one point, I think he was on the air for over 30 years. And he was on from like 7 to 9 in the morning. And on Wednesdays, for 5 Wednesdays, I got from 9 to 10. So I walked in there cold. I had no idea what I was doing. And because there's no talk format really set up for them, it was just a microphone and a big clock on the wall. And all they said was, when the clock goes to 10 o'clock Eastern time, you have to make sure you're off the air because CBS News comes in. I didn't even know how to do that. And we had all these things called cart machines. They looked like 8-track tapes, and that's where all the commercials were done. So I had to stick these carts in these machines, and at certain times press a button, and the commercial would run. And you talk about on-the-job training, man. I'm telling you, it was quite the education. But when I wanted to have a guest on, there was no way to route them to the studio. So what we had to do is take the telephone that was in the studio, a desk phone, kids, a big black 95-pound, you know, lead-looking desk phone. And I would take the phone and call the guest and then flip the phone around so the response, so the, you know, I'd be talking in the receiver and the ear part where I would be able to hear the guest, I'd put that up against the microphone so we would broadcast whatever they were talking about. You talk about rinky-dink. They had a thing called the Gettner unit back in the day, which would have made it a lot easier, but the studios, I remember, or I should say the radio station, didn't want to spend the $200, $200, so I didn't have to use the phone. And literally, I was on WDBC for a year, and for a whole year, first hour a week, then 2 hours a week, and by the time I got to 3 hours a week, man, I thought I'd hit the big time. But I use that phone that way. So when I think of the technology that allows me to talk to people and for people to listen around the world, it is really, really something else. And I'll tell you what else is something else. I am so very excited. Next week on March 9th, my friend and country music superstar, Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter John Barry is coming to Arlington Heights, which is literally a small stone's throw. Not even a big stone, a small stone's throw from Chicago in Arlington Heights. And he's going to be at the Hey Nani music venue and local kitchen, it's called. Pretty cool place. One of the premier places around the city of Chicago that you can watch and be engaged in live music. And he's coming up here to do a concert. The guy never comes up here because he's a Georgia boy and a Nashville boy. So this is a little cold for JB up here, but he's coming up anyway. And I'm so excited that I'll have a chance to spend a little bit of time on stage with him. I'm not going to sing. You couldn't pay me to sing. We'll let John sing. And we'll talk about that as well in just a few minutes. But next week when he shows up, I know this one is on the playlist.
Rosie never was one for turning heads. She was just always kind of there. She had a few nice features, more or less. No red ribbons in her hair. Since Aunt Jessie's been coming to the diner, folks are saying that she never looked finer. You ought to hear them say she's taking a shine to him, becoming the woman that she's never been. And all of the guys are wishing they days. Home of the diner, it was all the same to her. She didn't know any other way. Each afternoon now she starts to come alive, cause Jesse's there each day to pick her up at 5. You ought to hear them say she's taking a shot. Wishing they hadn't been so blind. She's taken a shine to light. Now there's a sparkle in her eye. They all missed a gem, a diamond within. She's taken a shine. Oh, what a little love can do.
In the 90s and early 2000s, John Barry placed 20 singles on the country charts, six of which went top five with Your Love Amazes Me, which we'll get to in a little bit, scoring a number one on the Billboard and Radio and Records country chart, as well as Standing on the Edge of Goodbye. You just heard She's Taken a Shine, earning the number one slot in Radio and Records. He has earned multiple gold and platinum records over the years. He was nominated for the ACM Top New Male Vocalist back in 1994 and won a Grammy Award in 1996 for his participation in Amazing Grace, A Salute to Country Gospel, Volume 1. This guy's got more. I mean, I could do the whole show just talking about his accolades, but I'd rather bring him on from his home just outside of Nashville. JB, welcome to the show.
What's going on, my friend?
Hey, man, you ever get tired of hearing all that stuff? It's like it just goes on and on. 40 years you have in the business.
Well, you know, it beats the alternative, I guess. Nothing to talk about.
Exactly. Does it seem like 40 plus years, John?
No. No, it seems like 3 weeks.
Wow. You know, I've been around you enough over the... By the way, this is so interesting. The first time we ever actually met in person, I was working at Oprah Radio. Do you remember this?
I do.
And I was producing one of the shows we were going to have you on, and we're going to do something different to have a country star on and talk about their lives like, you know, we do on this show.
Right.
And reached out, and it all worked out. And I remember you had this bus. You pulled up outside of Harpo Studios, and there's this whole line of people. And that's the people waiting to get in to see the Oprah show. And you got off, and Robin and the crew was there. And they're all like, wow, who's that guy? Who is that guy? And so it was a lot of fun to have you at the Harpo compound, as we called it. And we did a pretty in-depth interview that day. You brought your guitar into the studio and things like that. And I think it was the first time I started to appreciate how much difficulty, A, you've overcome personally to have the career that you have, and B, professionally, what a very challenging route you've had to take to have those accolades that I just, you know, read off.
It's been a journey, no doubt.
That's all you got? It's been a journey, no doubt.
Yeah, that's what it's been.
Yeah. Well, listen, when you started, you were just a kid. I know you were in this auto accident, and that put you on a stool for quite a few months, and that's kind of where you learned to play the guitar, and the early influences you had all were part of that.
Well, it was actually a little bit more than that. A motorcycle accident, a car hit me, and I walked with a cane for years, and I sat on. I really couldn't go back to the work I was doing, but at that time, I had already released my first album in 1979, and that accident was in 1981, and then my next record came out in 1982, and but. It sort of forced me into music full time because I didn't go to college, and the only kind of work I was doing at that time, I was working at an assembly plant in Atlanta, Georgia, and I couldn't do that work anymore because I couldn't be on my feet, you know, at all, hardly. And but I could sit on a stool and play a guitar. So that's kind of how I got into the music business.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, when you really sit back after all these years and look at that and say, you know, had this not happened or had that not happened, these other things don't follow. So it's not the preferred way of getting into the music industry, but it's definitely worked out.
Oh, yeah.
Do you think that these experiences, because that's just one of many, you know, brain tumor, cancer, you know, overcoming the odds and the difficulties over the years. I've said this to people before. I mean, I know you don't write all of your songs, but you're one of the few people I know that when you sing them, it's like I know you've lived them on some level. I suppose you'd rather skip some of that stuff, but it does seem to be part of your journey, these challenges.
Well, yeah, but everybody has challenges. And I think the, hopefully, it gives something that people can relate to with my music and knowing that I've been through things I've been through, and they can go, yeah, I've been through something similar to that. You know, I've been in a car accident, or I've had cancer, or you know, just different things, you know, and what it boils down to is that we are all just real people, just real live people. We're not supermen or women or superstars, or we're just people experiencing life together. And a lot of us have the same similar circumstances. And when we find people that have had the same life experiences or similar life experiences, it gives us something to hold on to, and maybe something to, you know, if they can get through that same thing I'm going through and accomplish what they've accomplished or do what they've done, and maybe I can do the same. Maybe I can get through this and be okay. So. Mm.
I've been to a few of your concerts, and I always wait for the lean-in point. And the lean-in point for me is like when you're singing one of your songs and you're, what you talked about, that connection is there pretty much right out of the gate. But at some point, one of these songs will come up and I've seen you kind of lean in a little bit more to the audience. And then the audience literally, whether they know it or not, is kind of leaning into you. Can you talk a little bit about that exchange that happens between a performer and people who've come to see them, what that feels like?
Well, it's an obvious point, and I really wish it wasn't so late in the show.
yeah,
you know, but it's that point when the band leaves the stage, and it's just me and them, and it's a very you can feel the room change, and it's really kind of cool, and so. We try to get that moved up as early as we can, so then the rest of the night we're singing songs and sharing a time that has more something about it.
Mm-hmm.
Hard to explain. Yeah. You know it when you feel it.
Yeah, and when I've seen this a couple times with other people that I've spent time with, and just around the bout, you realize you're right. There's this shift that happens. I think when people show up to an event, you know, they want to get away from life for a few hours. They want to forget about what's going on in the headlines. They want to get back to the lifelines, and they want to leave that stuff at the door or in the parking lot, and they come in. But it takes time for that rust to kind of chip off a little bit. You have I'm going to use the term rabid fan base to say, put it mildly. I mean, it's amazing to me. I watch this stuff that gets created and how these people follow you, and John, come here, and John, come there, and it's this constant thing. The Christmas tour, of course, is massive for you and the band, and you've been going out 25, 26 years now. Sold out, standing room only, stomping their feet. Nobody sings "O Holy Night" like you do. And I kept thinking, now he's been doing this part 25 years. But it never gets old to you, does it?
No. Christmas tour is a special run of dates, and it means a lot to me that you know, this past Christmas was our 25th year. And we've only missed 1 year in those 25 years. In 1997, I had to have vocal cord surgery, and so I had to. We had to cancel that year's run of dates, and that hurt. And but there's a couple of cities that we play almost every year. Macon, Georgia, is the one city we've played every single year. And matter of fact, during the height of the pandemic. We typically play the Grand Opera House in Macon, mm-hmm. which is like a 1,500 seat theater, remarkable room. But because of social distancing requirements, they could only allow like 300 people in, and normally it would sell out. And so they were talking about canceling the show, and the theater management and the mayor got together and said, no, that can't be. So let's move to City Auditorium. And so we moved down the street to City Auditorium, which seats like 5,000. And they sold, you know, they made allotment for the 1,500 mm-hmm. seats because it was almost sold out as it was. Wow. So, and that typically sells out every year. But that's the Macon, Georgia is the one city that we have played every single year we've done the tour.
You know, this voice thing that you have going on, and I know that you're aware of it. I know that you're a caretaker of it. And if I recall correctly, isn't your brother like an opera singer or something?
Yeah, he is. He sang opera for many, many years. You know, he's well into his 60s now, and 65 now, and does not sing as much. He teaches, and he is working with his daughter, who is a remarkable soprano.
Hmm.
And I would not be surprised if we don't hear some glorious things from her in the future. So.
But so where does it come from in you? I mean, it's one thing to have a trained voice, but I mean, you must have had some of that along the way, but you have this natural energy to your voice that I, you know, you don't hear, I don't want to say it's old, you know, oldies type stuff, but these days, especially in country music, first of all, not a huge fan, can't connect with it, don't care. But when I hear your voice, it just does it, you know, I mean, come on. But and I know you're with me, but you don't want to say it. But
for the most part, yes, sir.
Yeah. So I guess maybe the difference is, John, is that, you know, Merle Haggard did need bells and whistles, and Johnny Cash did need them, and you don't need them. But it seems like these days it's got to be about the bells and whistles. you know, the skinny jeans and the hats and the all the stuff that goes around it, that the voice is not the main thing. It's the song or the rhythm or the melody or how it's built around it. But you guys live on those voices. Where does it come from in you?
Well, I've just always loved to sing, and I grew up singing gospel music and listening to a lot of gospel music as a kid, and my mom loved Christian and gospel, and it sort of came. Matter of fact, I listened to my early records, and which I find it quite painful, but there's a tendency in Christian and gospel music to sing every note until the next note comes, which is what I refer to as over-singing. And I tend to do that. And I tend on my old records. And the difference is there's something, there's something about country music that especially, and I use this as example a lot, and I mean this with the highest honor and praise. Alan Jackson talks with melody.
Mm-hmm.
He sings in such a conversational way. He talks, it's like he's talking to you with melody wrapped around it. And I love that about his singing. But when I grew up, you know, I grew up singing in church and stuff. We just tend to hold every note out as long as you can until the next note comes. And so when I listen to some of my early records, I'm like, man, would you stop already?
Take a breath already, right?
Please, man. So, but as a result, I learned how to breathe so I could sing. And my brother, being an opera singer, he taught me how to breathe. And it's a bigger deal than it sounds, breathing correctly and mm-hmm. when you sing. But it was just, I don't know exactly where it came from other than the fact my mother had a lovely voice. My dad could have, but he was too busy being a construction worker. So
there you go.
My sister Susan had a lovely voice.
So it's there already. You just had to keep cultivating it.
That's about it.
Keep working on it. I'm going to drop the needle on Your Love Amazes Me, and then you can tell us on the other side what was going on at that time. For the people who already know all your music and that type of stuff, they're going to say this is a reminder. But for those of you who have not heard this song and don't know what was going on in John and his wife Robin's life at that time, this is pretty amazing stuff.
Came. I
got down on my knees out in the pouring rain. But only you could save me, and your love amazes me.
John in 1994, recently, just about a week and a half ago, I guess now, I was up visiting my son in Upper Michigan. I was driving late night on Route 41 between like the Rapid River area and Marquette, Michigan by Lake Superior, totally pitch black, snow and the whole thing. And that song actually came on the radio. I'm like, well, that was pretty cool. It stands up the test of time. When you hear that, though, all these years later now, John, even though it was a number one, you weren't celebrating like most people would have been.
No.
That's a short, right to the point, no.
No. No, the day it was the number one record on the R&R chart, May 10th of 94, I had brain surgery that morning. It's a tough way to get a number one record, but a guy's got to do what a guy's got to do. I had a keloid cyst in the third ventricle of my brain, and it took them... I went several months of just being miserable and meanest person on the planet and other things, and not realizing that there was anything wrong until got back in, I guess, into March, started figuring there's got to be something wrong. And in April, April 28th, our son Sean was born, and that day, I ended up going to the emergency room while I was at the hospital, and they discovered this keloid cyst. So. Mm.
You know, I mean, again, you were talking earlier about people going through certain things, and that song almost takes on a different tone and tenor because of what was going on at the time, because
yeah.
Robin, Superwoman,
yeah.
really not only just giving birth to your son, but she's making sure that you're okay as well, and... to this day, does so. I mean, it's really almost like, to some degree, her song.
Yeah, and at a time when, like I said, I had become like the meanest guy on the planet, I had pretty much abandoned her. I was in this cloud from February until May 10th. I was in a complete cloud. I was eating. I lost about 50 pounds or so, nauseated all the time, headaches all the time. Felt like she was cramping my style on the road, so I sent her and the baby-to-be and her daughter and my mother-in-law home. They didn't need to be out on the road, and you know. Anyway, so just long story short, she ended up being the nurse to the man who didn't want anything to do with her, so... And, yeah. You know, it's funny, my dad was a huge support for her when I was not. And one of the things that Robin told me years later that that he had told her that really struck her is that he told her, he said, Robin, love is a decision, not a feeling. I hope that you'll decide to love my son. And she did.
That's very powerful. So, very powerful. Well, you don't hear it put that way very often. You don't see that on Valentine's cards, John.
No, you don't.
That wouldn't sell because it's tough stuff. Speaking of tough stuff, then there's been more of this, and we'll get to this, what we're going to be doing together next week in just a second. But I think it was late 2018, going into 2019, somewhere in there, you were up this way or heading through Chicago, headed to Minneapolis, I believe. And we caught up with each other on your bus, and you and I and Robin and Mr. Smith and Bentley the Wonder Dog were all kind of hanging out in the parking lot of the Woodfield Mall. So anybody living in the Chicago area knows how big that is. And you were talking about, you know, this challenge that was going on that turned out to be throat cancer.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how much else does this guy need? But that was, you know, you talked about losing all that weight back with the brain tumor. And, you know, you're a stout fella. And I watched the pictures and I was, like many people, worried about you to go through the 35-plus treatments or whatever to get rid of the cancer in your throat. Arduous task, to say the least. But the day you rang that bell, I think the big thing for yourself, I would imagine, and Robin and everybody around you and those of us who enjoy your music were like, what's going to happen to the voice? And you came out of it, in some ways, I think, better than when you went in vocally, in my opinion.
It's crazy.
Isn't it something?
It's just crazy. People say there aren't miracles today. It's a miracle. Matter of fact, I near the end of my radiation treatments, I had 35 radiation treatments and 8 chemotherapy treatments. And the radiation, they would focus on, obviously, the throat, on the neck. And there was the skin on my neck was like, it looked like a football. This burnt leather looking kind of thing. And we got there near the end of the treatments, and Robin, she had not said anything to me about it. And we got there with the doctor, and she said, Doc, what's the white stripe across his throat? He doesn't have an infection or anything, does he? And the doctor got really concerned and looked at him. He said, oh, no. We knew John was a singer, and we programmed the radiation waves to go around his vocal cords.
Wow.
And it left that white mark on the skin. Now, that was a couple of years ago. They are much more pinpointed now than they were then.
Hmm.
It's crazy how fast, how quickly they're advancing the treatments. But, you know, my last checkup was 6 months ago. I go for another one in about a week. And last time I went, the doctor, he just told me, he said, look, I'm going to see you for every 6 months for the next couple of years. But he said, don't be worrying about this. He said, we got you so on the front end of this. He said, I've never seen it come back on anybody where we caught it so early. We'll continue to monitor because that's the smart thing to do. But he said, go live your life. The key here is what you hear all the time, and it's truth. Early detection. If you think something's wrong, go get looked at. You know, breast cancer, ladies, don't ignore those annual mammograms. You know, just go.
And for you, it was just like a feeling in your throat, wasn't it? You felt like you've swallowed something, or
I explained it that I felt like I had the skin of a Spanish peanut stuck in my throat.
That's pretty specific.
Man, that was it. It's exactly what it felt like, and it would not go away. Couldn't drink more water. Man, it's unbelievable. But it just did nothing would help, you know, because there it was. And that was in late October, early November. We recorded an album called Thomas Road during that time, and then did my Christmas tour. I saw a doctor at the beginning of the Christmas tour, and they thought I had a tonsil infection, put me on a round of antibiotics. About midway through, got another round of antibiotics and got home from the tour, and I got a flashlight, looked in the bathroom mirror, looked down my throat, and I was like, Robin, come here. I said, look at my tonsils. And she looks down my throat, and she steps back and goes, oh, my God. That looks like a tumor.
Oh, jeez.
She should be a doctor. She was right. It was. That's exactly what it was. It was a tumor growing out of my tonsil.
Oh, my
gosh. And they removed the other tonsil, and there was a tumor developing in it.
What?
Yeah.
Wow. The life of a country superstar, huh?
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah.
Awesome stuff. Next week, you're coming up to Arlington Heights to Hey Nani, local kitchen and music bistro. This is a really cool place because it's a bit of a bistro, but it's got one of the best intimate performing stages in the Chicago area. And they have shows racked up, I mean, day after day after day. They're a very popular place. This was originally scheduled, I believe, last fall, maybe, we were going to try this. And, of course, Cyrus the virus pushed that out of the way. Things are very different here in Chicago now. The mask and vax has been lifted in the state of Illinois, so we're glad for that. But this was already on the schedule to come up and sing at Hey Nani. And since you don't get up this way very often, I started having a couple thoughts about, well, yeah, I'll come out and watch you sing. It'd be great, and this and that. And I started thinking a little bit more about something that you and I have touched on in the past, is John Denver. And, yep. And I believe you have, in some of the concerts, Annie's Song. I've seen those. It's fascinating and fantastic. But your version of Back Home Again for the CMA 50th anniversary, I've had people that didn't see you and thought it was John.
Yeah.
And I'm like, now how does that happen? So next week, we're going to be having just a little intermission type thing from your usual list of hits. And you're going to do three or four songs, and I'm going to kind of talk in between them with some of the moments and memories that I have of John. As I mentioned earlier in this show, when I got into radio, I had no business doing any of what I'm doing now, but it was John who 3 years prior to me getting on the air said, listen, your voice matters. You have to do something with this that you've been given. I had no idea what he was talking about, but a year later, and I'll talk a little bit about this next week, a year later, at the Windstar Choices for the Future Symposium, Dr. Mae Jemison, the first female black astronaut in history, was supposed to speak, and she opted out for some reason, and John calls me to take her place. And I had not written a book, JB. I hadn't been, nothing to do with radio. I hadn't done a TED Talk. There were no TED Talks. It was none of what I have accomplished since 97 was anywhere on my radar, but somehow he saw something in me I didn't see in myself. And I don't dismiss that. So whenever I have a chance to kind of share some of that with people to remind them of what they're here to do and that maybe there's something bigger calling, I find, you know, it's important to do that. And you've had experience as well with his music. You've mentioned John is probably your biggest musical influence.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I got the John Denver wall here in my my room here. I've got some album cover that he had signed and a photo that you had passed on to me, an RCA promo photo, and a poster and a single. And
you still got that bus thing?
Yeah, I got that. If any of your listeners have ever seen a bus going down the road, the name of the artist, they used to put them up in where they used to put the name of the city the bus was headed to. They put the artist that's on the bus, you know. Mm-hmm. And I got one of those that's got John Denver's name on it. Some bus nut who knew I was a John Denver fan got that for me. So,
awesome. It is. And I'm going to drop the needle on Back Home Again. We'll come back on the other side and talk a little bit more about what's going to happen at Hey Nani. So this is JB doing cover of Back Home Again, Song of the Year 1974 for John Denver. This was done for the CMA 50th anniversary.
There's a storm across the valley, clouds are rolling in. The afternoon is heavy on his shoulders. There's a truck out on the four lane, a mile or more away. The whining of his wheels just makes it colder. He's an hour away from riding, all your prayers up in the sky. 10 days on the road, I've barely gone. There's a fire softly burning, and supper's on the stove. It's the light in your eyes that makes him warm. Hey, it's good to be back home again. Sometimes this old farm feels like a long lost friend. And hey, it's good to be back home again. There's all the news to tell him. How'd you spend your time? What's the latest thing the neighbors say? And your mother called last Friday. Sunshine made her cry. You felt the baby move just yesterday. And hey, it's good to be back home again. Sometimes this old farm feels like a long lost friend. And hey, it's good to be back home again. And all the times that I can lay this tired old body down, feel your fingers feather soft upon me. The kisses that I live for, and the love that lights my way, the happiness that living with you brings me. It's the sweetest thing I know of, just spending time with you. It's the little things that make a house a home. Like a fire softly burning, and supper on the stove, and the light in your eye that makes me warm. Hey, it's good to be back home again. Yes, it is. Sometimes this old farm feels like a long lost friend. And hey, it's good to be back home again. Hey, it's good to be back home again.
I remember the first time I heard that, I just thought, who is this guy? And to this day, his music has resonated with millions, obviously, of people around the world, and still does. And one of the reasons we're actually kind of collaborating next week is this is the 25th year anniversary of John's passing in October of 1997. I did a tribute to John when I was at Oprah Radio that you were part of, as was Michael Martin Murphy and Annie Denver and just a slew of people. And one of the things that kept coming up as a recurring theme with all the conversations I had, and I think Annie said it, she says, people will not let him go. There was something he brought to the world that was not there prior to him doing it. And when I think of the music, it obviously stands on its own, you know, 14 gold, 8 platinum albums, excess of 60 million albums sold around the world. But to me, it was always the work. You know, the music's fantastic, but the work that he did with the platform he was given is the thing that I think resonated most with me.
Oh, yeah. He made great use of what was given to him to speak to what was important to him. And without a doubt, he did.
When you covered that for CMA, got to be a little bit surreal. I know you were at a concert in the 70s, and you probably heard him do it on stage, and then here you are all those years later for CMA.
I was at the Back Home Again tour in 1975 in Atlanta. Saw him. It was the first time I ever saw him live at the Omni. Huh. And went to that tour and was just blown away. Blown away.
Hmm. Well, next week, I think we're going to have a similar experience. I don't know about, it's not exactly the size of the Omni in Atlanta. but I'm encouraging people to come out. And if you've not seen JB in concert, it's going to be an amazing event, with a lot of the hits that top the charts. And of course, we're going to take this little segment at some point during the show. And John's carved out some time to do 4 songs, and I'll kind of talk about some of the things around all that. You know, John, it is interesting to me. There's a lot of things I find interesting, but this is one of them. You know, to live your life in a way that 25 years after you're gone, people still want to sing your songs or talk about your work. I think it kind of doesn't get any better than that.
No, no, it's pretty remarkable. And I think with John's music, it's going to be years and years and years, centuries. It's just a great music. So,
Well, I look forward to seeing you. And is Miss Robin going to be with you?
Yeah, and Mike Steele, my bass player.
Oh, very
Mike,
good.
He's been playing. He's just awesome. Sings with us, and the three of us singing is a pretty cool thing. So,
looking forward to that. Looking forward to being in the audience and also spending a little time with you on stage and talking about John Denver. If you want to get tickets, it's Hey Nonny. It's in Arlington Heights. It's HeyNonny.com. Or you can go to JohnBerry.com and get tickets there. March 9th, a week from today. And from what I understand, the way the seating is set up, the cabaret seats, the ones right up front, they're sold out. But there are seats right behind them and around the outside of the stage that are still to be had. And tickets are selling, and we're glad to see that. You don't get up to Chicago very often. Obviously, Macon, no. Georgia, places like Nashville and things like that are your sweet spot. So we're hoping to make this a regular stop for you.
I'd love to. I love coming up there to play, and it means a lot to me to get to have you join us and for us to have a little segment of John Denver songs and stories.
And I don't have to sing, right? No singing? You'll handle that?
No, I don't know. I don't know about that now.
Thank God I'm a country boy in Chicago. All right, John, safe travels. We'll see you guys next week.
Thank you, my friend. Look forward to it.
My thanks to John Berry for taking time out of his schedule to catch up with us on the Life 2.0 podcast. And again, open invitation to join JB and I at Hey Nonny in Arlington Heights. It's 10 South Vail Avenue, Vail like Vail, Colorado. And you can get tickets online for the event. It's March 9th. The doors open at 6:30. The show starts at 7:30. Hey Nonny, HeyNonny.com. Or you can go to John Berry's website for those tickets, JohnBerry.com, BERRY. And it's not a big place. It's an intimate setting. But as I said, some of the seats have already sold out. And once this gets out, they'll probably sell out the rest of them. We also may have some other interview stuff coming up in the Chicago area. So all that being said, what a unique evening it's going to be. As I said with John, he doesn't get up this way very often. Grammy Award-winning country singer-songwriter, slew of hits, fantastic voice, amazing performer. This is something, and it, you know, a lot of the times when he does these concerts, you know, they're, as you mentioned, 1,000, 2,000, 5,000 people. This is close-up and personal setting. So really, really looking forward to that. And also, as I mentioned, this little interlude we're going to do featuring John Denver's, covered by John Berry. And I'm sitting here in my studio. Up on the wall is a poster that John Denver gave me back in 1993, I believe it was, after I spoke at the Windstar Choices for the Future Symposium that I mentioned earlier in the show. And I had given this away probably in around the year 2000. I was on the air in Michigan. A guy came to perform there. I really enjoyed what he did. We came back to my studio back then in Michigan in the Upper Peninsula, and this was hanging on the wall. And he was, I'm a huge fan. And I said, listen, you know what? It was gifted to me from John. I gift it to you. And I forgot about it. And how many years later? Geez, 20 years later, I'm getting ready to do this show called The Bridge, where I was in daily contact with co-hosts in Beijing, China. The concept of getting people to talk and connect and in conversation so we can avoid a lot of the stuff that's going on in the world as best we can. A conversation does that. But anyway, just before this bridge thing was to start, I get a Facebook message from the guy that I gave the poster to 20 years ago. I didn't even remember his name until he reached out. And he says, hey, do you remember this poster? And, oh, yeah, vaguely. Yeah, I remember it. He says, well, I'm moving and I've had it framed and I've up in my office all these years. I thought it was time for you to have it back. And he sent it back here. And when I opened the box, I got a little bit of emotion connected to it. One, it was from John, so that's cool. But his work, as I mentioned in the world, was profound to me and remains so to this day. He used this formidable platform he was given with that voice and the music around the world to bring the world closer together. And the work of the Windstar Foundation back in the day, in the 90s, 80s and 90s, did exactly that. And so I have people who I know from back then that have followed some of what I've done to this point and have remarked about, you know, the intent of what I do. And I said, listen, it all goes back to that. It goes back to John and saying, do something with your voice. You've been given this talent. Do something with it. Don't waste it. And while I have faltered on this path many times, I've never wavered, and I'm good with that. So as I'm sitting here talking to John Barry, I'm looking up at this poster, and there's this line that runs all the way back through it for me. All the way back. It started with listening to this guy's music when I was a kid. I had no way of knowing that we'd ever be connected and be friends, and he'd support. There's just no way to predict all that stuff. I'm just very, very thankful that it did happen. And even though 25 years he's been gone, long time, as I mentioned, imagine to be living your life in such a way, and the legacy that you leave endures, is longer than the life that we had. It continues on. And I think for those of us who knew John and those of us who respect the work that he did, we're just trying to take care of a little unfinished business, if you get my drift. So with all that being said, I look forward to seeing you next week at Hey Nani. That's Wednesday, the 9th of March. The doors open at 6:30. The show starts at 7:30. At some point, they're going to drag me on stage. I'm not singing. It's not going to happen. Maybe just under my breath, but I'm sure not getting behind a microphone. I don't want to scare people away. And you can get tickets at heynani.com, H-E-Y-N-O-N-N-Y.com, or johnberry.com. And I look forward to seeing you. And this is one of the songs that JB's going to cover. It was a big hit for John Denver in 1974. Until next time, thanks for listening. Safe travels. Be well. Adios.
You fill up my senses like a night in a forest, like the mountains in springtime, like a walk in the rain, like a storm in the desert, like a sleepy blue ocean. You fill up my senses, come fill me again. Come let me love you, let me give my life to you. Let me drown in your laughter, let me die in your arms. Let me lay down beside you, let me always be with you. Come let me love you, come love me mountains in springtime, like a walk in the rain, like a storm in the desert, like a sleepy blue ocean. You fill up my senses, come fill me up.